Hello, I'm Rob Gillett, and this is Show This Thread, the podcast that goes beyond the character limit with the best people on Twitter. Each week, I'm joined by a special guest who I've met through the platform to discuss their life and work and the part that Twitter plays in it all. This is episode 4. Thank you to everyone who has listened so far. Please don't forget to subscribe, and if you have a moment, I'd be ever so grateful if you could rate and review Show This Thread on Apple Podcasts. Just be nice. On this episode, I'm joined by award-winning YA author and screenwriter Simon James Green. Simon's debut novel, Noah Can't Even, was published in 2017, charting the journey of geeky teenager Noah Grimes as he comes to terms with his sexuality. The sequel, Noah Could Never, followed last year, and Simon's third novel, Alex in Wonderland, has just been released. We discuss all three books on the show, as well as Simon's work in schools and the recent protests by parents of some children in Birmingham over equality being taught in the classroom. I began, though, by asking Simon how Twitter influences his writing process.
I actually use it quite a lot for inspiration, actually, and because of the stuff I write is mainly young adult, I find it quite useful to follow accounts that are either written by that demographic, by teenagers or for them.
Yeah.
Just in terms of kind of keeping up to date with kind of how they talk and what they talk about and that sort of thing. I find that a really useful thing.
There's quite a big sort of YA community, isn't there, on Twitter? I see a lot of interaction between you and other authors and the fans as well.
Yeah, there is. The YA community is a great feature of Twitter, definitely, and definitely as a support network and keeping up to date with things that are happening professionally. But also, I think just beyond that, even, it's a really interesting place to be just for actually following people in that demographic who aren't anything to do with books sometimes. Because you forget sometimes what it's like, and especially if you're writing contemporary YA, you know, what for example, the school system is like these days. It's changed a bit from when I was there. And so it's quite interesting following teenagers who are going through exams, for example. And not that I'm kind of snooping in a kind of creepy way or anything, but it's interesting to see what is on their minds and how they're communicating that and the language they are using. And I do try and feed a little bit of that into my characters I write, for sure.
Yeah, because I can imagine that's quite challenging aspect of what you do is that idea that you kind of need to have two heads on your shoulders at any one time, and one of them is the character who is consistently in your case being a sort of teenage boy, and the other is you as a writer who is working professionally in this sort of in this world.
Definitely. It's I mean, it's also quite it's a fun aspect to it as well, definitely. There is two elements to that, and I think as well how that plays into how you talk to people on Twitter as well, and what your persona is as an author. Not that it's not authentically me, but you have to bear in mind sometimes who you are talking to and how you're phrasing it, I think, and the sort of topics that you're willing to talk about on Twitter, bearing in mind what your books are like. I suppose I learnt quite early on to steer clear of anything too potentially controversial on Twitter, for example, and that's something I tend to steer away from as well.
Kind of naturally brings me to a point that perhaps I thought would come further into the conversation, but you obviously do quite a lot of work in schools, and there's this big debate going on at the moment, which shouldn't be a debate, about kind of the LGBT aspect of education.
Yeah.
How have you found, what's your experience been? Presumably, when you go into a school, they're quite welcoming anyway.
Mm. Yeah, I think a lot of secondary schools that have booked me to go in have done so because of the LGBT aspect, and they specifically want a session, a talk or workshops with those elements in it, which is great because they want to, you know, reach out both to their LGBT students, but also the wider student community, to, you know, open up a discussion or awareness about those issues, which is fab. But my experience has been overwhelmingly positive, actually. What I have found is that compared to my own school days, the students seem naturally a lot more open to it. There's a lot less resistance to it. And there's also a greater awareness anyway, about LGBT people and the LGBT community, which is really it's really heartwarming. Actually, it's been really nice. A lot of schools now I've been into have LGBT clubs and societies for the students, and there are always students who are openly gay or lesbian or bi or trans who will come and talk to me after a after an author talk, and say hello and thank me for the book and all that sort of stuff, which is really, really nice. And it's wonderful that they are able to be themselves in those schools. I'm not sure it's like that necessarily everywhere and in every secondary school. I'm almost certain it's not. And I'm fairly sure there are some schools still out there that wouldn't dream of having me in to talk to the kids. But it's really nice that there has been a definite change over the last few years.
I guess in a way, that kind of the reason that I came to discover you and made contact on Twitter was very much a sense of having read the first book, the first Noah book, that I wanted to just say to you, like, you know, I wish I'd had this book when I was 12 years old.
Yeah.
And it there just wasn't anything.
No.
If there was, it wouldn't have been there. If it had been in the school library, it would have been there by accident.
Absolutely. I mean, it was, yeah, it was same for me. I mean, I was at school when Section 28 was absolutely in force, and there's no way you would have had that type of book with that content in the school library, in the same way that you wouldn't have had it discussed in sex ed classes or anything like that. And a lot of people have said that to me. It's really terrible and sad and awful that that was the case, and that there's so many of us who would have benefited from those types of books when we were growing up, and you know, that simply wasn't the case. And it's wonderful now that those school libraries do have those books in, and so many of them do brilliant pride displays and get all their LGBT books out, and they're sort of proudly on display in the school libraries. And that's a really wonderful thing to see. It's really great to see how much has changed in a relatively short space of time, actually.
It's also really, I think it's a really important place for that change to begin. School libraries are sort of bizarrely, or not bizarrely, but curiously powerful places for the children that want to spend time in them.
Yeah, they definitely are. They're a fountain of knowledge, they're a place of entertainment, they're a great place. I mean, for me, when I was at school, it was a kind of a place of safety from some of the more school bullyish types who would parade around the school playground. You know, so it was a place to go at lunchtime where you could feel safe, actually, as well. I think to this day that's still sometimes the case in a lot of schools as well. Well, kids have said it is, so I think it's very much still the thing. But yeah, they are. And school librarians are a fantastic type of person as well, who are really passionate about getting books into the hands of kids, and also really good at telling which books are right for which student at which point in their life. And I've met loads of really fabulous librarians who are so good at doing that. So good at knowing the students and getting to know them and understanding them, and have really good relationships with those kids, which then goes on to getting the right books into their hands, and passionately wanting to find the stuff that excites them and makes them want to read. And that's difficult when we all know that, you know, there's always news reports about how teenagers don't read books anymore. But those librarians are doing everything they can to really buck that trend, and a lot of them are doing it really successfully, which is brilliant.
Well, and also, you know, that's going to work a lot more effectively if the children can read books that they can relate to, or
yes,
or gain a sense of,
yeah,
sort of, I mean, ultimately pride about, yeah, themselves through the characters they read.
Yeah, so important. And I think that's something that was, you know, is forgotten sometimes, and was for many years, I think, is if they can see themselves in the book in some way, that's a brilliant thing. And also, you know, a lot of them want books which will compete in terms of entertainment value with watching their favourite show on Netflix, I think. We shouldn't forget that books are competing against all those other forms of media out there for their attention. So I think as creators and authors and publishers, we have to make sure that our content can rival that they would see on screens, on YouTube, whatever it might be. And that's about, it's about creating compelling characters that they relate to. And I think it's also about the way that sometimes we write as well. and look at ways structurally of helping that as well. For example, you know, can you make the chapters shorter in order to hold their attention a bit more?
Well, it certainly worked for me.
Yeah, it worked for me too. I love a short chapter. That's how I like to read books, and it will always make me want to read more, I think, when they're shorter.
I totally agree, and you know, I don't think it's necessarily anything to do with reading ability. It's definitely a stylistic thing that I like. It keeps a sort of a pace there, and you've got those, you know, mini cliffhangers all the time.
Keep you reading on, and also a sense that you're making progress, I think, which is quite a nice thing.
I kind of dived in there into a sort of good but deep conversation about schools, which is fine. But I think probably for the uninitiated listener with your work, it would be good just to talk about the Noah books, your first two books, and the character and the world that he inhabits.
Yeah, well, the first book was Noah Can't Even, and that came out in 2017. That was my debut novel. And it's the story of a geeky teenage boy called Noah, who lives in a small town in rural Lincolnshire, not dissimilar to where I grew up. And he thinks he likes this girl called Sophie, who's the most sophisticated and glamorous girl in the school. She's got perfect stationery, and he thinks that's a really good selling point for any potential girlfriend. And she ends up inviting him to a party, and he thinks that might be his chance to actually finally kiss her. But at that party, instead of kissing Sophie, he ends up having a snog with his best mate Harry instead. And that's a sort of seismic event which completely throws his world upside down, because up until that point he didn't think he might be gay. And now suddenly he's wondering if he might be, and Harry certainly is. Harry comes out to him quite early on. And so the book really is about him trying to work out who he is, really, in that first book, against a backdrop of his increasingly chaotic home and school life with all sorts of crap going on from all sorts of angles. And then the second book that came out the year later, the sequel, Noah Could Never, with Noah having kind of worked out who he is in that first book, the second book is really about him learning to love that person and love who he is and realise that he is himself worthy of love and lovable. And that second book, whilst equally crazy, deals with things like body image and those sorts of issues, which I think can definitely affect boys as much as girls. And certainly for Noah, what he sees in terms of the gay community, in terms of the images he's seeing online and on websites, is very buff guys with perfect pecs and abs and that whole muscle protein shake type.
Yes, yeah.
And that's really intimidating for him as a scrawny, barely 16-year-old who has, you know, no muscle development whatsoever and is hopeless and awkward. So he feels really inferior and doesn't feel like there's any reason why Harry would possibly like him. So a big part of that second book is him getting over that and learning that it's not important and he has other qualities. But his insecurity drives a lot of the drama in the second book. So those are the two Noah books, and there's also a little short story called Noah Goes Nuclear, which is just a little standalone thing about him going on a geography field trip to a nuclear power station, which goes hideously wrong, obviously. Noah.
I love both books, and I think Noah's a brilliant character. I was thinking about it earlier, and it's sort of almost there's something about him that's almost Mr. Bean-like in his ability to turn a sort of something going slightly wrong into a full-blown catastrophe, which brings about some brilliant humour. I was thinking, Sophie comes around to his house and he's trying to make the tea, and it just kind of goes wrong, and it's something so domestic and seemingly simple, and
it still goes wrong,
spectacularly wrong.
Everything he touches, he does seem to make into a bit of a disaster. Definitely has that about him. I was really keen with Noah to write a gay character that wasn't mired in tragedy and angst. I felt that was really important. And so Noah's comedy really came out of that, because not that there's anything wrong with books that have those types of characters, but at the time I wrote Noah, I had read a lot of LGBT books, which YA books, which were just a little bit sad, or the gay character would either be dead at the end or commit suicide or something horrible would happen to them. I just felt it would be nice to explore some other angles to that, and for LGBT teens to realise that actually there is lots of awkwardness and happiness and laughs regardless of your sexuality. And that was a big part of what I wanted to do with Noah, was show that side of things. And he is a little bit extreme as a character in that sense, and the comedy is somewhat heightened, definitely. But I think hopefully that just adds to the fun of it and the hilarity of it, which is what I really wanted to achieve with those books.
I mean, the comedy as well, and the characters that surround him, with his mum, who is a Beyonce impersonator.
Yeah. Appalling.
and then the in Noah Could Never, you've got
the drag queen
war that's about to erupt. So there's some brilliant comedy around that. And you know, I was actually really touched by the grand character.
Yeah.
Just like from a very personal level, you know, my nana was a massive part of my growing up, and you know, she's now in a home, so that was all like very much kind of relatable.
I mean, a lot of those characters are based on real people that I've from my own family. Not my mum's not a Beyonce tribute at, but to be clear, I had that in there quickly. But the grand character definitely is. I mean, my gran ended up in a home as well, and before she died, she had that sort of mild onset of dementia happening as well. So actually a lot of the conversations with Gran in the book are based on ones I had with my own Gran. So that comes from a very real place. And even the drag queen stuff, actually, in the second book, when I first came to London, I was involved with doing quite a lot of cabaret shows in Soho as a producer. And I worked with quite a number of drag queens during that time. So a lot of that drag queen stuff is very much based on my days in Soho, producing drag cabaret shows, which is really good fun. But those people really do exist. They are that glamorous and fabulous and over the top, which is a wonderful thing.
Well, I really like the way that with the sort of small town setting, you know, these characters take on an even larger than life aspect than they would in the city.
This is the thing with small towns, and why I was so keen to set it in a small town is that the smallest thing becomes huge in a small town, and there's nowhere to hide and nowhere to escape, and because nothing else is going on, everyone likes to dip into your business and gossips about it. And that was my experience growing up in Lincolnshire, in a small town. That was very much the case. You couldn't really do anything without everybody finding out about it and talking about it. And that's definitely what I wanted Noah to experience, so that the smallest thing that would happen to him would be absolutely blown out of all proportion in terms of the level of drama connected with it.
Well, you become very aware of that. I mean, I grew up in a small village in Suffolk on a farm, so I can, again, another point where I could relate very intently there, and you're acutely aware of how big a deal anything is, you know, whether it's coming out or you know, anything to do with your family. So you don't lose perspective, because that is the perspective in that context.
It is, yeah, absolutely. But it's really funny, because now I've lived in London for quite a few years, I really notice it when I go back home, because in London everyone just keeps their head down and gets on with it. I mean, you could do anything in London practically and nobody would raise an eyebrow. But that's really not the case when you go back to those small little towns and villages.
Yeah, but you didn't hear a pin drop if it was in the wrong place.
Yeah, definitely. Lots of tutting.
So the new book will be out by the time people hear this. In reality, it's about a month away.
Yeah, June the 6th it comes out, so yeah.
So tell us about that. Alex in Wonderland.
Alex in Wonderland, yes. A break from Noah, but still in the same kind of area as Noah, really. But so Alex in Wonderland is a standalone YA novel. Again, hopefully people will find it funny, although I think the comedy is not quite as madcap as Noah is possibly. But Alex is, he's just finished year 11, just finished his GCSEs, so he's 16, and it's in that sort of the, what I remember as being that long, hot, glorious summer between GCSEs and A-levels, where lots of things change, really, and the book is all about change. Alex lives in a seaside town, which I imagine to be somewhere kind of maybe on the Kent coast or somewhere like that. And it's one of those places that that for years has been down on its luck. There's a lot of unemployment, quite a lot of poverty, quite run down, one of those sorts of places, but which has recently had an influx of Londoners buying up cheap property. And so the place is now changing. Suddenly sourdough pizza places are setting up, and there's galleries, and street food is being served on stalls, and that sort of carry on, sourdough, that type of thing. So that's all happening. So the town of New Sands is changing, and at the same time, lots of stuff is changing for Alex as well. And it's in that moment he's moving into a new stage in his life, finishing GCSEs, people are moving off, some of his friends are going to college, other people are doing other things. And he starts the summer really down because his two best friends from school have basically hooked up and are going on holiday without him, and so he's got no friends. His dad's new partner, who he doesn't like, wants him to get a job for the summer and earn some
She's
money.
A nightmare.
She's a nightmare, isn't she? She's a horrible sort of stepmother type, really sort of passive aggressive towards him. And so he thinks he's going to have the worst summer ever, and it's not looking good. And he's also a bit like Noah. He's an awkward kind of boy. But Alex had an extra element to him, which is he has a kind of an Eeyore complex going on. He's always quite down on himself, whereas Noah isn't particularly. But Alex has been dealt a bad hand and feels it deeply, and so is a bit gloomy about life in general. But anyway, he gets a part-time job in the end at a rundown amusement arcade called Wonderland, which is on the seafront. And he meets a new group of friends there, basically, and slowly life starts to change for him. And there's a plot as well in the book about the fact that Wonderland is in financial trouble, and so him and his new friends start to set about trying to find ways to save the place and maybe update it a little bit to appeal to this new crowd that has started to come into New Sounds recently. And also they start getting some threats and some nasty letters through the post as well that makes it look like maybe some people in the town don't want Wonderland there. Maybe it attracts undesirables and they'd rather see it gone. So there's a few other things going on as well around it. And of course, Alex falls in love, naturally, with Ben, who appears to be a straight boy with a girlfriend who's away travelling. So, of course, that's just typical Alex luck that he would fall for a straight boy. But that doesn't stop him pining after Ben for most of the book. Regardless,
the setting of the sort of rundown seaside town,
yeah,
really. I don't know. I think everyone's been to a place like that, yeah, like at some point in their life,
yeah.
And it comes across really well. I mean, I as a child and a teenager would go to Felixstowe in Suffolk,
right, yeah,
which again is sort of one of those places that's now turning around a bit.
Yes.
But I could almost sort of smell the place when I was reading the book. The sounds and the noise.
I've always had a weird fascination with those sorts of places. I mean, as a kid, yeah, the same for me. I had a lot of little family holidays and outings to a lot of those seaside towns on the Yorkshire and Lincolnshire coast, so places like Cleethorpes and Scarborough and Bridlington and Mablethorpe and Great Yarmouth a bit further down. And I've always had a strange fascination with, especially actually with the amusement arcades in those places, which are a mix of weirdly captivating and glamorous yet bleak and depressing at the same time. And I love that that contradiction in them. There's a horrible desperation about them, but you've got all these glittering lights and the promises of riches and fortunes if you play the machines in the right way.
Well, I think also as a kid, you know, I used to go in there armed with bank bags full of 2p
pieces, 2p coins,
and spend hours kind of trying to work out the way to put as many in the slot at the same
time
in order
push-ups.
To push them all off the shelf. And you're sort of oblivious to the sort of proper fruit machines that are around the edge where people with, you know, real kind of...
real money were winning sort big.
Of, yeah, real risk going on is happening. You're not really aware of that.
No, but those penny pushers, you love them. And, you know, when they have a little watch in there or an actual £10 note or something, which is tantalisingly close to the edge, it's brilliant. I mean, they're so close to falling off the ledge. How can you fail?
But they never do.
They never do. It's amazing. But I love those things. And I love the con artistry of those places, actually, as well. I'm fascinated by how they get you in there and keep you in there and the way those machines work. It's the same thing. I have a similar thing about fairgrounds in general and the sideshows you get there and the way they operate and the little tricks and scams they use to make sure you don't win. I did quite a lot of research about what they do and how they do it, and I just find it absolutely fascinating.
How questionable is it legally?
It's hard to say, really. I mean, if you think about the penny pushers, they have the sort of escape chutes at the side, which feed straight back into the machine, not into the winning tray at the bottom. But that's in plain sight, and you can see that quite clearly if you use them. And they tend to have a little lip on the edge of the sliding. The little sliders as well, which sort of helps stop them all the money falling off at once.
Means it requires the force of an elephant to actually get anything off
actually
the edge.
Do it. But I mean, I think in terms of fairgrounds almost, I guess you sort of expect it, really. I don't know how much they get away with in the general course of things, but I like the notion they get away with a lot, to be honest with you. I think it's quite fabulous and clever, and I'm all for rewarding that if you're, you know, silly enough to try.
That leads me on quite nicely, really, to another question I have, which, I mean, relates to all of your books, actually, is they've all got this kind of mystery element to them. There is a something to be solved. Where does that come from? Have you got kind of a love of of those sort of detective stories?
I have. I always, growing up, I loved Agatha Christie mysteries, and I've always loved any kind of mystery plot with red herrings and clues and something to solve along the way. I think from a craft and structure point of view, a mystery can really help drive a plot, actually, and keep people interested, which is one of the benefits of it. But just from a personal point of view, I've always loved putting little things in which can then be neatly tied up at the end. It's almost like a challenge, really, a sort of a jigsaw, I suppose, in a way, of just seeding things in through a plot and then being able to connect them all at the end. Because I find that very satisfying as a reader. So I like doing it as well as a writer, really. And I love anything. I mean, I love a mystery on TV as well, or film, or something clever that happens, some kind of clever twist or something like that, I think is great. I mean, it can be a nightmare to write, if I'm perfectly honest. And quite frequently, when I was writing Alex and the Noah books, I did just think to myself, for God's sake, why didn't you just do a straightforward romance plot that doesn't have to be all these clues that then have... Because, of course, when you try and edit something or you change a section with a plot like that, you could suddenly completely screw yourself. Because if you take out the wrong thing or the timeline doesn't quite add up, you can... The ramifications working back or forwards can completely mess it up. So you spend a lot of time having to re-go over it to make sure that it does actually connect in the right kind of way. It makes sense. So I did curse myself quite often when I was writing it, but hopefully it still hangs together.
But actually, those sort of two threads, the romance and the mystery, particularly in Alex, they work really well together, because the mystery is the driving force of, you know, not just the romance, but the friendships as well in that story. And that's one thing that I really loved about it, was this group of strangers who, and this is, it reminded me of like being a teenager or younger and going on your 2-week holiday in the summer and making friends. And your holiday friends being about 100 times better than any other friends you've ever had, even though that in reality you'd spent the first 3 or 4 days, like always with my sister, being like, you go and talk to them, you go and talk to them. And then you probably spend a grand total of about 6 or 7 days together, and in that time there's just this intensity.
Yeah, it's really intense and wonderful,
the relationship, and that's kind of what comes across in the book with the you know, the particularly the three, the Alex, yeah. Ben and Effia.
Yes, yeah.
Nearly forgot that one. Effia, yeah. Alex, Ben, and Effia. That sort of triangle,
yeah,
that
little
of
trio, yeah.
You know, working together on this mystery. It really kind of has this really nice bond that forms very quickly in the book.
Yeah, and I think that's what it, again. That I think that for me, that chimes back to that whole summer, that intense summer after GCSEs and before sixth form. You know, which I remember really distinctly for me, and it was a very intense period of time. And you know, when you can get to know people really quickly and really well, and then it's kind of weird because September comes round, it's sort of back to normal and people drift their separate ways again, you know. So but it's a kind of magical period of life, and it doesn't really ever, in my experience, repeat itself much after school particularly, I don't think. It's not something, I mean, sure, you meet people on holiday as an adult, but tends not to be quite so intense.
Tends to just be a bit uncomfortable.
A bit uncomfortable
and competitive.
Awkward. A bit competitive, a bit unpleasant, and yes, disappointing. And then you can't get rid of them and you just wish they'd go away and stop bothering you in the hotel bar every evening, thinking they're your best mate.
We were away last year and sat by, was it like an all-inclusive place?
Yeah.
Sat by the pool, just relaxed. And actually mostly wasn't British people. It was a real mixture of this was in Mexico, a real mixture of people from all over. And we managed to sit next to the sort of one other British couple, and a man and a woman who clearly hated each other.
Oh, yeah.
And she was definitely making the most of the all-inclusive drinks.
Yes, good.
And just decided she had to talk to us. But all she wanted to do was tell us how much better her holiday was than ours. So she was like, how long are you here for? We're like, 7, just a week. Oh, we're here for 2.
Yes, like, yes.
Why are you talking to me? Like, you don't make me feel bad.
It's amazing, isn't it? I know. I don't know why. It's so disappointing. I mean, it's, you know, at what point people become like that, you know?
Yeah, where does the switch occur?
Where does that switch occur?
I do not know.
Or maybe they were just obnoxious teenagers as well. But in my mind, you know, I suppose it just depends. But, you know, in my mind, teenagers are always much more open and almost normal, and then at some point some of them become just vile adults.
Yeah.
Not all of them.
Yeah.
Some of us are nice, obviously.
Some. A few. So at this point, so I mean, we're talking, Alex in Wonderland is out in about 5 weeks,
yeah,
I guess.
Gosh, yes, frighteningly close.
Like, how do you feel now in this part of the process?
I mean, it's terrifying because it's nice working on a new book when it's just you and your editor and possibly your agent as well, just working on it and, you know, sharing thoughts and ideas. Fantastic. And then suddenly it's ready to go out into the world. And I'm well aware that I think Scholastic have just had the very first early copies back from the printers today. So it will start gradually going out to reviewers and bloggers over the course of the next few weeks. And that's the moment where you get to find out what people think, whether they like it or not. And I think it's maybe not as scary as it was for Noah, my debut book, because I've kind of become hardened to it now and have a bit of a thicker skin. But I remember when it happened with the first book, it was just awful. And certainly when you get those first reviews on Amazon or Goodreads, which now I've learnt not to look at all, it's a horrible moment.
How do you handle that part of it? Because obviously it's presumably quite nice to read nice things, but you don't want to become constantly refreshing the page.
No, you don't. I don't read any reviews on Goodreads ever, and I don't read them on Amazon anymore either. I will read if bloggers tag me into a good review on Twitter or something, or Instagram, I will happily read it, and that's very nice. And it's a nice thing. It's nice to hear from people who appreciate your work and share your vision of something. That's great. I'm not really that interested in reading anything negative because it's difficult as a writer anyway. You're always full of self-doubt about what you're doing.
Yeah.
And of course, there are always going to be people who don't relate to your work and don't like your style and don't like what you're talking about, and that's totally fine. they're more than entitled to do that, but it's not helpful for me to read it or know about it. You're never going to write anything that everyone's going to love. I mean, that just doesn't exist. And so there's always going to be some people that don't like what you've done. But equally, hopefully there'll be more that do and love it. And so that's fine. So you cling on to those people, and that's who you write for. And that's a great thing. It's interesting with YA fiction, I think, because I think everybody should read it and everybody can read it, and that's great. But ultimately, you know, there is a demographic that you're aiming it at. And they're the people, the kids, the students, the teenagers that I go and visit in schools, who that's who I think of particularly when I'm writing a book, and that's who I'm aiming it at. But then you have lots of adults who read YA, and rightly so, because it's terrific and they get a lot of enjoyment out of it. But I think sometimes you do get those reviews that comment on the immaturity of the teenage character, or that type of comment, to which my response can only be, well yeah, they're 15 or 16. Of course they make bad decisions, and decisions that don't make any sense to you as a 25 or 35 year old or 40 year old or whatever you are. You know, it's very easy to look at those choices a teenage character makes and just think they're ridiculous and over the top, and why do they do this or why do they do that, and forget what it's like to be at an age where you're in a situation that you don't have any context for, and therefore do things that are stupid quite often.
Yeah, it's something I was going to kind of talk to you about, because I obviously I don't have children. I don't have teenage children. I'm a 35-year-old man, and I've enjoyed all of your books.
Yeah.
How common is that? How common is that scenario? Because I know the sort of YA thing does spread to a broader age range.
It does.
You know, I'm not. I have read quite a lot of YA stuff, but it's not entirely what I read. But
yeah,
particularly with your stuff, you know, I've kind of really
got
into it, really, really enjoyed it. How often is that the case?
It happens quite a lot, actually. I've been contacted by a lot, and I meet a lot of adult readers of all ages, actually, from people in their 20s right through to people in their 60s and 70s who have read and enjoyed the book. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that. I think YA fiction shares a lot of similarities actually with popular adult commercial fiction, in that it tends to tell a story in a compelling, snappy kind of way, which appeals to the way a lot of people want to read. They don't particularly perhaps want to read heavy going literary fiction. They want something maybe that has some depth to it, though, which YA does. But I think it's written in such a way that it's very accessible, which is very appealing to a lot of people. But then also, I think as well, the coming of age aspect of YA is something that appeals to people of all ages, because it's a period of life we've all been through, and that whole process of growing up and things changing. I think as you get older, maybe you romanticise it slightly, but I know for me, it's still a really important part of my life that I think about, and I look back on actually really fondly now. Maybe it's with rose-tinted glasses, but I think reliving it can be a very enjoyable experience. But I think as well also for LGBT people as well. I've had a lot of gay readers get in touch who are perhaps a bit older, but maybe never quite got to live their teenage years as they might have wished they could have.
I think how I feel about it. You know,
I think that's quite. I think it's very common, and understandably so. You know, so it's almost like they can vicariously live what life might have been like had they been a teenager now, possibly. And I think that's a really nice and important thing, that you can give people that opportunity for something they weren't able to experience because of the way society and the world has been. And I think that might be another reason why particularly gay YA has a quite a large adult readership. That would make sense to me, certainly. And I certainly have met quite a high number of gay readers who've said that's the case and the reason that they've enjoyed it. So that, I think that's a really nice thing.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately, it's a new thing in that respect, because it wasn't there
it wasn't.
When I was in the school library.
So, exactly.
You know,
But now it is. So we're playing catch up in a way. Yeah. And that's nice that we're able to do that.
Earlier today, I read your short story, Penguins, from the Proud anthology that Juno Dawson's put together, which is a really nice story. I really like that.
Thank you.
And that kind of to the sort of subject matter we were discussing earlier, it's very timely in the themes of that, which just in very brief terms is about some gay penguins arriving at a zoo and then ultimately people protesting their existence,
as of course they would,
but also with a lovely kind of romantic element as well. But that's a really nice story. How did your involvement in that come about, and what's that project about, just a bit more broadly?
So it's the Proud anthology, which is published by Stripe. So it's a collection of short stories, poems, and illustrations as well, because every piece is illustrated, all by LGBT authors, poets, and illustrators, and all around the theme of pride as a kind of a loose theme. And it came about, basically, I got an email one morning from Juno Dawson, who said, would you be interested? It'd be great if you could come on board. And I said, absolutely. It sounded absolutely amazing and has been absolutely amazing and a great thing. I think we're a bit behind in this country in terms of our output of LGBT YA books. A lot of the books out there are US based. And from US authors, and they're great, but it's really important, I think, that the UK experience is represented, because it's not identical to what happens in America. And I think British teenagers need representation as well, so it's really important. So the nice thing about this book, although it does contain some US authors as well in it, it has originated out of the UK, and it contains a majority of UK-based writers and illustrators, which is a really nice thing, I think. And so I set to work thinking about it, and for a little while I'd been mulling over this idea of the whole gay penguins thing seems to come up every year in some form or other.
Yes.
I mean, most famously, it's that couple of penguins at the zoo in New York in Central Park, I think, which had the picture book written about them. And Tango Makes Three, that's called. But every year there's another gay penguin story about some penguins in a zoo. So I thought that was a really interesting thing for a start. And then I thought, well, what happens if you're a teenage boy who's about to make his big coming out announcement, but is pipped to the post by these gay penguins who kind of steal your thunder? So not only that, but then you start to look at the way everyone's reacting about the penguins, and it starts to give you second thoughts about coming out, because it's all been such a fuss with the penguins. Like you said, the protests and people talking about it and analysing it and dissecting what it means, and is it possible that animals can be gay, the whole nature or nurture debate, that type of thing. And it really sort of interferes with Cameron's feelings about coming out at all. So I thought that was quite an interesting angle to take with it, and to explore a coming out story, really. So that's what that one's all about. So it was great fun.
Yeah, really nice. And that aspect of kind of stories like the gay penguins, which, as you say, is a kind of real world thing that has been reported on. The idea that how people report those things and how they are then discussed has an impact on people is really important, and I think gets very easily forgotten, and particularly in like a home environment where you know, it's on the front page of the paper and mum and dad have got something to say about it, which they're not meaning to do harm, but they don't know the context in which those comments are being heard.
This is exactly the thing, and I think very pertinent, like you said. You know, now we know we've you know, had this period of time where there have been protests by parents outside schools in Birmingham about LGB content in the schools being discussed and talked about with the kids. And of course, children, teenagers of all ages are going to have seen those reports, are going to be aware of them. They'll be aware, even if they haven't looked into it in detail, they'll be aware of the general discussion around it. And it does, of course, it impacts on you, because you're going to start even if you dismiss those people as bigots or religious nutcases or whatever it might be, there's still that thing in the back of your mind that people out there think you are wrong or bad or inappropriate, and that's a really dangerous thing. Mm. When you're at that very delicate stage of trying to work out who you are and trying to be proud of who you are and be confident in yourself. So you're absolutely right. It does impact on people, and it shouldn't be forgotten. Yeah.
We haven't talked massively about Twitter, but to be honest, I don't mind because it's been very interesting. something that I just sort of ask everyone is about the people that they like to follow on Twitter, and I don't know if it's something that you kind of can bring to mind quickly, but just the sort of almost the sort of thing you like to look at or specific people.
I'm quite a diverse range, actually. I mean, yes, obviously other YA authors and bloggers, definitely they form a big part of people on Twitter I follow. Equally, librarians, especially school librarians and school libraries, it's great to have that connection with them as well, in terms of talking about the book. But in a wider sense, some of my favorite accounts actually are things, quite often a lot of the foodie accounts that are based down in Devon I quite like, because I really like Devon as a place. I like to go there on holiday and that sort of thing. And I'm obsessed with a lot of the restaurants down there. That's really amazing, really fresh, delicious food, obviously with it being coastal as well, some great seafood and stuff. And so I follow quite a few of those accounts in a kind of a sort of fantasy sort of way, almost like I imagine myself living down there in some fabulous barn conversion or something, enjoying a rural existence away from all the hustle and bustle of London.
It's really nice to know what the day's special is, yeah, when exactly, you're in London,
exactly,
isn't it?
Exactly. No chance of me getting there, but I can have a look at their little menu and imagine what it's like having the freshly caught mussels, whatever.
I like
got.
That, though. It's a nice thing to, think about.
Yeah, it is when you're stuck on the overground somewhere, in rush hour. So those are some of my favourite accounts. But I think Twitter is great for just generally keeping your eye on what's being talked about. And there is no doubt that I've over the years I've had a lot of inspirational moments as a result of Twitter, either in terms of characters or the way people speak or topics or just things in general. And that's a wonderful thing. Twitter can also be a stressful place, though. It can be a place sometimes where, the debate gets very heated, and I do sometimes have to step away from it, in all honesty. There are times when it can just become a bit too much, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone I've spoken to has said something kind of similar to that effect. And you've already said that you tend not to wade in with kind of controversial views, but views on potentially controversial subjects, which I think is ultimately quite sensible to bring stress immediately back onto yourself.
I mean, for me, I think it's because I don't really have the headspace to deal with having to then engage with people about anything I've said. It's not that my views wouldn't be controversial in that sense, but you know what it's like if you start tweeting about something, people will come in with another. I mean, whatever you tweet about, actually, someone's going to have an opinion somewhere. And I quite often do take breaks from the whole thing entirely, because if you're not careful, it does take up your entire working day quite easily.
I can imagine it's quite a disruptive force when you're writing.
It's a nightmare.
It's a sort of very different mode.
Very different mode. Very easy just to flick onto it and have a quick check and then get embroiled in something. Before you know it, you've lost an hour and nothing's been written.
With all that in mind, what would be your kind of one piece of advice for people about how to get the most out of a platform like Twitter?
I think what I've found is find a core group of people who share your interests and share what you're trying to do. You can build a really good network. And some people say you can't sell books on social media, on Twitter or whatever, but actually I think you can. I think not that it's about that, but you can certainly it's important, I think, for reaching fans of your work and fans of books and communicating with them. I think it's a really nice thing. And I think it's nice to have that slightly more personal connection with people who are reading your work. But equally, I think it's just about finding those like-minded people, I think, and following them and engaging that sort of conversation. I think that's the best way to approach it. But also not to be on it all the time, that it takes everything out of you and everything up. But it can be all-consuming, and I think it's about being sensible with it.
And so finally, what's next for you? Is there more Noah on the way, another book in the pipeline?
There's no more Noah at the moment, although the door is always open for a third at some point, depending on what happens. But at the moment, I am I'm working on some ideas for a book for next year, which I think will be another standalone YA novel. So I'm at a very early stage at the minute of working out possible plots and characters and how they might speak and what their voice is and all that sort of stuff, which is exciting, but also it's at that point where it's also slightly stressful because it feels like it all might be a bit shit if I'm not careful. so it's at a delicate stage, but all being well, that will come out in June 2020. Roughly. So that will be a book that I'll be needing to write very much over the sort of summer, so that it's ready for editing by the early autumn. So it's going to be another intense period of time in terms of getting it ready.
And where do you tend to write? Do you work at home, or would you go away? Or
I generally work at home. I have a little office at the back of the house where I shut myself away, and I work from there. I do occasionally. I've gone away for a week and written somewhere. I'm not the sort of person that can write in cafes, sadly, or anything like that. So I'm not. I can't take my laptop down to the coffee shop and get anything done whatsoever.
I can barely write a text message in a cafe. Oh. I'm too interested in what everyone else is doing.
Interested in that, or irritated by other people's. Mm. Chatter and what's going on, so it's, I found that to be impossible. I basically need total silence to write, so I have to shut myself away.
Simon James Green there on Show This Thread. I love doing that interview, partly because I've enjoyed reading all of his books, but also he's just a really nice guy. I have to say that was pretty much unedited as well. The only bits I took out were where I was waffling on. Simon's new book, Alex in Wonderland, is out now. It's the perfect summer holiday read. You can get that, the Noah books and Juno Dawson's Proud Anthology featuring the Penguin story, in the YA section of your local bookstore. There's more information on all of those and links to everything else we talked about in the show notes at showthreadpod.com. Thank you to Simon for taking part, Scholastic UK for their support, and Working Title Films, where the episode was recorded. Next week, I'm joined by Nick Walker. He's the man behind the hilarious Daytime Snaps account, which takes screenshots from daytime TV shows and posts them to Twitter with absolutely no context whatsoever. Don't forget to subscribe wherever you're listening. You can also follow Show Thread Pod on Twitter for news and updates. I've been Rob Gillett. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next time on Show This Thread.